A Biblical Theory of Sex, the second talk in a series entitled Understanding and Living with the Dynamics of Sex, was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 3, 2007, in McKinsey Study Center's Wednesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Last week we talked about marriage, had a conversation about marriage. This week we're going to have a conversation about sex. The format, for those of you who weren't here last week, is just to have a conversation with me being the air traffic controller, more or less. So feel free at any point to interject, ask a question, make a comment, whatever. This is as free-flowing as we can have it in this kind of, with a group this size. I'm going to make a few comments to just get us started thinking about this, and then feel free to enter in. We talked about the nature of marriage last week. You should have notes. If you don't have notes, they're either floating around or I have a couple copies here. We talked about the nature of marriage last week. Just to review briefly, I argued that there are really basically two aspects to marriage. It's a moral commitment. Marriage is making a vow, is taking on a commitment that I see as a moral obligation that I have, a moral obligation to grant unique loyalty to my spouse. What I'm saying to my spouse is I will keep you unique. No one holds a higher place in my life. I reserve the most intimate knowledge of myself to give to you. That's one of the promises that we're making. And the other one is a moral commitment to bring about what the Bible calls one fleshness. And I think what it means by that is such a uniting of our lives that it is as if we live one life existence in common rather than two separate life existences in parallel. And we're committing ourselves to do that when we take on the commitment of marriage. So to fail to work toward that end is basically to fail to keep our commitment and to keep our vow. Now, the reason we talked about marriage first, from my perspective, is that human sexuality is distinctly and decidedly different from animal sexuality. Maybe that's obvious. It's becoming less obvious in the culture and in the day in which we live. But from a biblical perspective, to talk about them in the same breath is to make a huge mistake, because human sexuality is not about sex. Human sexuality is about marriage from the biblical perspective. So that's why we dealt with marriage first, because we can't really understand human sexuality as the Bible would understand it without first understanding what marriage is. So we talked about that. In the modern anthropological approach, it's the other way around. Marriage is an institution created by man to help him manage his sexuality. The sex drive is the given. Marriage is the man-made invention that we use to try to channel it. In the biblical approach, sexuality is a real human dynamic created by God to help mankind in their pursuit of marriage. And we'll talk about exactly how, what form that help takes. The created given is marriage. Sexuality is a divine invention to facilitate what marriage is all about. So that's why I maintain that human sexuality is fundamentally different reality from animal sexuality. Animal sexuality, the biological drive and instincts, the instincts to mate and reproduce, is the given, and that's all there is to it. There ain't no more. In human sexuality, it's not about pleasure. It's not about procreation. It's not about self-gratification. Human sexuality is about, and that's what we need to talk about, what it's about enhances what marriage is. So in order to understand, I think, the biblical perspective on marriage, we have to understand a concept that I want to introduce, the concept of a natural language. Artificial language would be like German, English, French, the languages of the world. Human beings invented those languages as a way of communicating. You have to learn the language. you don't come hardwired or programmed to understand what German means or what English means or what French means. You have to learn the language. It's an artificial language. A natural language is of such a nature that the meaning of the language is hardwired into the human psyche. So the philosopher Thomas Reed argues, for example, that when I run my fingertips over this, music stand. When I run my fingertips over this music stand, the fact that it feels rough to me, I don't need to be taught that. I know that. It's native in my intelligence itself, is that I know what that sensation in my fingertips means about the world, about the music stand in particular. So Reed argues that that sensation in my fingertips is a natural language. And every human being who has any human intelligence at all knows the meaning of natural language. Thomas Reed does not say this, but I'm saying this. I'm saying that sexual intimacy is a natural language, and that that's the only thing that can make sense out of the biblical perspective on sex and sexual intimacy. In the biblical view, sexual intimacy is a natural language which has for its inherent meaning a promise of marital commitment. And so what I mean by that is if I were to be sexually intimate with someone, whether I like it or not, whether I think I intend this message or not, whether I set out to communicate this or not, the fact of the matter is, with my body, I'm saying, I am all yours. I belong to you. And what I would argue is, because it's a natural language, there's really no way that we can, without completely brutalizing our psyche, without bludgeoning ourselves psychologically, there's no way we can shut down that meaning. That just is what sexual intimacy means and what it conveys and what it communicates. So I'm arguing that we are psychically wired, hardwired, to equate our body, and particularly our genitalia, those parts of our body which we identify as most intimately me, and we have a sense of that. We are psychically wired to equate our body with our very selves. I am my body in a significant way psychically. So that facilitates the meaning of sexual intimacy, because if I will give you my body, so we understand, then I will give you my very self. If I will commit my body to you, I will commit myself to you, because the body and the self are psychically connected in our understanding of ourselves. So therefore, giving my body means a giving of myself. If the other person, he or she, will share his or her body with me, there is nothing that they will not share with me. That's why it is so incredibly incongruous. You know, you see those movies where somebody's having a one-night stand and they've just had sex with each other, and one of the lovers reaches over to take a drink of coffee or Coke that the other person was drinking, and they say, "Wait, that's mine." And it's just, I mean, everything about that strikes you as incredibly incongruous. You've given them your body and you won't share your Coke? I mean, give me a break. That's because that's what it means to give someone your body. It means there is nothing that I will not make one with you, allow you to share with me. My whole life is given to you to share with you. Further, giving intimate knowledge of my body is giving that which is most intimately me, and giving my body in this way means that I am therefore willing to give anything else, and therefore everything else. I will withhold nothing. And now let me just briefly give an argument for why I think this is the biblical worldview, because it's not like you have a theory of sexuality ever presented explicitly in the Bible, so this has to be gleaned from the clues that are available. And I would say there's three major clues. First of all, it just is the case, this is not really biblical evidence, but it's important evidence to my point. It seems to be universal human experience that sexual intimacy means roughly what I have just described. You look at the movies, you look at the literature. Everywhere you turn where human beings have talked about relationships and sexuality, you get the same problem that they confront. Even when we want sex to not mean anything, we can't help ourselves. It just does. You know, how many times do you have lyrics in songs that say, you know, I thought we agreed together that we were just going to have sex and it wasn't going to mean anything. Didn't we agree on that? So why do I feel so betrayed this morning? And that dilemma gets explored by human beings because they can't figure out, why can't I just shut my mind off? Why can't I just have sex be meaningless? Why can't it just be recreational? Why can't it just be fun? Why can't it just be for pleasure? Why can't it be casual? Why does it always get messy? Why does it always entail entanglement of some kind? And there, so many human beings are trying to find their way to the new world, the wonderful heaven of sexual freedom, where you can have sex without obligation, sex without responsibility, sex without entanglement. But it can't be done. And I would argue the reason it can't be done is because it's hardwired into us. Sex and sexual intimacy was created by God to mean something, and I can't make it not mean that. Hard as I try, I can't do it. So I think it's the universal human experience that just is what sexual intimacy is to us. Three points under that. Much of the reward of sexual intimacy, notice, is feeling special to another person. That's. I read a journal article once. Philosophers are weird. But I read a journal article once that was basically asking the question, why would we never be satisfied with an orgasm machine? Paul Simon had a song. What was it? Some big green pleasure machine, something like that. A pleasure machine would never make sexual intimacy obsolete, I would argue. And that's what almost everybody recognizes and agrees, is that just giving you the world's most wonderful orgasm isn't going to satisfy what it is that we are looking for in sexual intimacy. So it's not about pleasure, not really, not mostly. Sexual intimacy is about what gets communicated to another person about them being special to you. And that just is what sexual intimacy says. It may be a big, huge, fat lie, and that's my next point, or my third point, the meaning of, the second point, if sexual intimacy is not followed by behavior consistent with what sex means, we experience this incredible incongruity. You had sex with me. You don't even know my name? Why is that incongruous? It's not incongruous for dogs. Dogs don't mind who it is that they mated with. But human beings have a problem with that. We can't just mate with someone and then not have it seem really, really odd that our lives are not committed to one another and that we're not given to one another. And that incongruity is because of the meaning of sexual intimacy, I would argue. And then the last point, I already sort of intimated this, but the meaning of sex is not imposed by us. We don't give sex its meaning. We can't separate the act from its meaning, even when we want to. And thus, all the dilemmas in the movies and films where people are struggling with, why can't I manage to separate sex from its meaning? Secondly, I would argue that biblical sexual ethics makes no sense under any other interpretation of sexuality and sexual intimacy. Assume for a second that the primary purpose of sexual intimacy is procreation. What ethics would follow from the fact that the purpose of sex is procreation? Well, pretty much the ethics of dogs. Anyone, anytime, anywhere. Or at least close to it. I mean, you might be able to argue, well, you have to stay with the woman long enough to help her raise the kid so that they don't get eaten by lions. And then you can go on. But Otherwise, the biblical ethics doesn't really make any sense if the purpose is just to bring little critters in the world. If that's what it's for, then why this faithful monogamy that the Bible teaches? Assume that the primary purpose of sexual intimacy is pleasure. Then again, the ethics that would seem to follow from that is anyone, anytime, anywhere. Who can you play chess with? Anyone, anytime, anywhere, as long as they know how to play chess. Why is sex not that way? And why is the ethics of sexuality not that way? Because it's not recreational. It's not just a good time. It's not just for the pleasure of the experience. But what if you assume that the primary purpose of sexual intimacy is a God-given means for celebrating, for ratifying, and communicating our mutual lifetime commitment to give ourselves to one another, our very selves to one another? Then the ethics that follows is exactly what you find in offered by the Bible, faithful monogamy. One man committed to one woman for lifetime, having pledged their loyalty to strive to become one and share everything and share my very being with the other person. If that's what you're celebrating, and sex means that, and always means that, then sex becomes very appropriate in the context of that relationship in a way that it would not be appropriate in any other relationship. So the purpose of sexual intimacy in God's design, as I would see it, is to... The other clue, and the only biblical reference that has anything to do with this, is 1 Corinthians 6, 12 through 20. And we can talk about it to the level of detail you want to. I'm not going to go into detail in my initial comments here. But what I would argue is that if you look at that, it's a very cryptic kind of argument. It's hard to figure out what he's saying. And a lot of people say a lot of bizarre things about that passage and give it a very bizarre reading. But what I would argue that he's saying is he's talking about the incongruity of being one with Christ on the one hand and then seeing a prostitute. Now, some people read it as if you are mingling your essences, which have been mingled with Christ, and now you're mingling the essence of Christ with the essence of a prostitute, and that just gets bizarre. I don't think Paul is being quite so spooky and bizarre. All he's saying is to be one with Christ means that you have given your life to have your very life defined by your unity with him and what he teaches and what he stands for and who he is and so on. So to be a disciple of Jesus means you're committed to truth and you're committed to goodness and you're committed to loving other people. I mean, there's all those things that Jesus taught that you're committed to if you are one with Christ. And then Paul's saying, now what are you doing when you go see a prostitute? Well, you're having sex with her. But don't you know what Genesis says, he says? The two will become one flesh. Now, if we go back to Genesis, I think it's wrong to understand Genesis to be saying that something metaphysically happens when you have sex with somebody, that you become cosmically one with them. I don't think that's what Genesis is saying. Genesis is talking about marriage there, not sex. So when he says the two will become one flesh, he's talking about the appropriateness, the propriety of a man and woman making a promise to one another to share their life together. That's the one fleshness that he's talking about. So when he talks about sleeping with a prostitute and yet quotes a passage out of Genesis that has to do with the commitment of marriage, he doesn't spell this out, but it seems to me there's only one point he can be making. Don't you understand that when you sleep with a prostitute, you're making a promise to her with your body? And yet you don't have one shred of intention of following through on that. So you're one with Jesus and everything that he stands for, and yet you're lying with your body to this woman. How do you reconcile that? Those are completely incompatible. Those are completely irreconcilable, that you'd be so casually lying to another human being with what you do with your body. How can you claim to be one with Jesus and have that make sense to you? I think is what he's saying. But notice, if I'm right about the argument there, then his whole argument depends upon seeing sexuality as somehow saying something and making some kind of promise that's of a on the order of a marriage commitment, the promise of marriage to another person. Well, that makes sense if my theory of sexual intimacy is correct. Okay. Let me just finish this, and then we can just open it all up. So what's the purpose of sexual intimacy in God's design? To provide a language and experience whereby a married couple can celebrate, communicate, and ratify their mutual marital commitment to one another. So what's fundamentally wrong with extramarital sexual intimacy? If I'm sexually intimate with any other human being that I am not committed to sharing my life with and becoming one flesh with, the big problem is it's a deception. It's a lie. It's a falsehood. Now, I can see people in our day and age saying, oh, is that all? You mean you're just lying to them? Oh, phew, I thought it was serious. Yeah, that's all that's wrong with it. That's unlike what I was taught when I was growing up. You know, when I was growing up, the strategy toward young people with respect to sexuality is to scare them to death, to scare them into virginity somehow. And the way you do that is to say things like, every time you have sex with somebody, you're giving a little piece of yourself away. It's like a shark taking a bite out of you. And, you know, too many of those and there ain't much left of you, that sort of thing. It probably works as a scare tactic, but I don't think it's at all relevant to what the Bible is saying. What nothing of the sort happens. But what does happen is I'm lying to another human being. I'm deceiving another human being with the language of my body, with the action of my body. And that's serious, you know. The problem is we're lying to another human being about that which is probably the most important thing to that other human being, their own sense of their specialness. I mean, that's what we all long for in this life, is another human being out there who is so committed to believing that I'm special that I can spend the rest of my life experiencing myself as special in the eyes of that other person. So when you tell them they are special and then don't follow through on that, that's probably the most treacherous lie any human being can tell another human being. I mean, it goes to the depths of their psychological and emotional needs, and it's ripping them off where they are most vulnerable. So that's why it's serious. That's why this kind of lie is serious, let alone lying itself is treacherous in any form. And if we don't understand that, then we need to fine-tune our moral barometer a little bit. We need to come to take goodness and righteousness and integrity and honesty and truthfulness more seriously than we do. If we can lie in any sense casually, there's something wrong with our moral sensibilities. Okay. I'll leave the last one. We can talk about what exactly does constitute sexual intimacy. That may come up, but why don't we stop there? I'll give you a chance first. Do you want to add anything or? Okay. Questions, comments, objections, criticisms.
I agree that it is important. I think that's a good picture about it being a lie. If you're not willing to make that marital commitment with someone, and then we see just in reality the things that surround that lie, the fact that people get diseases and that children come into the world without two parents and things like that, just seem to fortify the idea. I mean, you can use those as scare tactics because they're very real to, you know, what can happen when you don't get married but have sex. But then it's kind of like it's so confirmed by the fact that serious things happen sometimes.
Yeah, but it is important that we keep in mind the why it's wrong is not because of venereal disease.
Not the fundamental. reason is wrong. I appreciate that.
Because drugs can't fix what's wrong with what's immoral about extramarital sexual intimacy.
Jack, could you just comment on you're talking about sexual intimacy in outside of marriage, but even sexual intimacy inside of a marriage can be used inappropriately.
Yes. No, that's really true, because, again, if I don't follow through in what it is that I'm promising, even in the context of marriage, then I'm lying, again, even within the context of marriage. Yeah, that's a very good point, that even without sex, we've made a promise. I mean, that's what the wedding was. That's what the marriage vows were. And so I need to follow through on that. But if I decide, no, I don't want to follow through on that, I just want to use this woman, or I just want to use this man for self-gratification, and that becomes the pattern within a marriage, that's just as wrong, just as inappropriate a use of sexuality. That's a good point.
I think it's pretty obvious, but when you talk about extramarital being a lie to that person, of course, you didn't mention the part, maybe because mainly you're talking to people that aren't married, but the lie that it would cause to the person that the commitment was made to.
I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing you. So.
Well, I guess what I'm bringing up is what you didn't talk about in a lie of extramarital sex. Also, what you didn't talk about was the commitment that it defies to the marriage.
So you mean adultery?
Right.
If you
were saying it's
one person, then you're having sex with somebody else.
Yes. When you said extramarital, I guess I was also thinking of adultery in that category.
Yeah, and I meant it.
But when you said it is a lie to that person of whom one has sex with, you didn't mention what it does to the one
In the case of adultery, it's actually a very treacherous betrayal of the one that I am married to, that I made my vows to.
Which obviously we all know, but I just
good point. Yeah.
Okay, this might be kind of a fine line, but I'm a little bit confused. You were talking a lot about purposes of sex for procreation or pleasure. What about people who are in a very, very committed relationship, and that's not how they see it? They see it as, you know, this is just kind of almost a perk, but they're, you know, they have a relationship that's very serious to them and that's they see as being long-term, but then they haven't said those "we're married" words, and yeah. But that's the purpose for them is of...
That's the purpose of...
Sex is like... The purpose of it is like that commitment that they have to each other, which is very serious to them.
That makes
sense.
Okay.
Can I take a shot?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are you saying that... Islam? Okay. Are you asking what if two people are very committed to one another and they look at their sexual relationship as ratifying that commitment, and they're not married? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, and I know we talked about that last week with marriage, but even like a step back, like maybe we're not going to be together forever, but we're very, very committed to each other or something like that.
We're committed for now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, what it comes down to is the big, huge myth that underlies all of our attitudes towards sexuality in our culture, and that is that this thing called love warrants and justifies sexual intimacy. It's not love that justifies sexual intimacy. It's the marriage commitment. And the marriage commitment is not, from a biblical perspective, what makes the marriage commitment a marriage commitment is not, tell you what, I'm going to share my life completely with you until I get tired of it. That's not a marriage commitment. I'm not sure what that is, but it's not a marriage commitment. A marriage commitment is in it for keeps. The till death do we part of the vow. that I'm giving my life to you for the remainder of, I mean, for the entirety of my life. As long as I exist, I'm promising that I am going to be a husband to you. And she's promising that she will be a wife to me. So that's the context in which sex is appropriate, because that's what sex is promising. That's what I'm arguing is the meaning of the natural language of sexual intimacy. So when that's not the case, then there's a discontinuity between what I'm doing with my body and what I'm prepared to commit to morally. And that therein lies the problem.
So probably you could have a lot of situations where someone, you know, said they were really committed, yeah, in it for the long haul, but if they're not kind of willing to make that next step, it's probably just because there's other things going on.
Well, I could add a couple things to that. And I think that's the risk involved when you offer to share yourself with someone on that level. And I think we have a culture that says that's, you know, kind of like the model you're suggesting. We're just going to do that because we are really connected for now. We don't have so much the sense of, I'm doing this forever. But the trouble with that is that I'm still participating in this natural language that Jack is talking about that has my body saying to that person and their body saying back to me, this is forever. And so for whatever reason that doesn't last, then it's incredibly devastating. And Jack mentioned kind of cauterizing ourselves against, I think so much of our culture has just decided, well, it's just kind of normal. It's not going to last forever. So you just got to take what you can now. And this is good now. This is really good. And we're going to take it while it's here. But I think that's just as devastating, because if it only lasts a year, or even if it lasts 5 years, it's incredibly difficult to extricate those two lives because of the nature of this language that it's been promised and it's continuing to be promised. And it's very devastating for that to end.
Good evening.
There are people who I think have managed to completely suppress the meaning of sexual intimacy in our culture, and it's becoming more and more common. But I don't think they're not very tender people. They can't do that without cauterizing, without hardening themselves, without steeling themselves, without becoming jaded in a certain way. They're kind of brutalizing their humanity in order to have this freedom to not have to be committed and yet be sexual.
Good evening.
Go ahead.
Oh, no.
Well, I was going to add one other thing, and that is just...
I'll try again.
Okay.
Later.
Hold your thought. Stay with it. I might have just forgotten it. I did. It'll come back. No worries.
Sorry.
Stefan, that's okay.
I kind of wanted to change the subject too a little bit. What I was wondering is if we have any sort of biblical reference to what sort of boundaries one has as far as before actual engaging in actual sex. Is it totally based on how much you can handle, or is there some sort of outline or guideline that we have that we can find that says stop at second base or something like that?
You won't find a biblical guideline. These are written in a culture where, burkas are closer to the culture that they lived in than America and our patterns and our. So there is incredible modesty and incredible separation and incredible self-restraint. There just wasn't There wasn't physical contact between men and women in those cultures. So if we were to go on biblical practice, we're way gone in our culture. I don't think you should judge that on practice, because that was cultural. However, I do think that I would be very conservative in that regard, because what I argue in my last point here is that sexual intimacy is mostly a mind game. You can have, you know, I've heard conversations where a man and a woman are 20 yards apart talking to each other, and it's an incredibly sexual experience between them.
It's why you can sell phone sex.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's a mind thing. And it really is a matter of the attitude of the heart. There's all kinds of ways that we convey to another person, I'm yours, take me. And whenever I'm conveying to another person, I'm yours, take me, even if there's no touching involved, I think that's sexual intimacy. And I would argue that I think that's just as wrong as any other kind of sexual intimacy. I just think that's inappropriate. Because the only place where that's appropriate is in the context of a relationship between a man and a woman who are committing their lives to each other, where it's really true, I'm yours, take me, everything that's mine is yours. Then it's appropriate. So there's, and it's important to know that it's a mind game. You can't draw the line at an action. There's a kiss, and there's a kiss. There's holding hands, and there's holding hands. You can hold hands affectionately and you can hold hands erotically. You can kiss affectionately, you can kiss erotically. And it's the erotic part, or what we call erotic, that's what makes it sexual. That's what makes it the kind of intimacy where you're communicating to the other person, I'm mine, take me. Oh. That's why it never worked for me.
Jack's a product of the me generation.
A couple things. One, you said it's a mind game. And I think that could mean that it's all negative. And if it is within the commitment, if it's not a lie, you're talking about that this is communicated by our emotions, by our psyche, by our nonverbals, that it doesn't have to just be communicated with our body. So it went with you saying it's a mind game. It could make it sound like it's all is manipulation versus us using our emotions and our mind, or it coming naturally within the fact of a commitment that we use all of ourselves to be communicating sexual intimacy.
I didn't mean that to be...
Right, I know you didn't.
To denigrate it. I mean, within the right context, it is part of sexual intimacy, is that we communicate in so many different ways to our wife or husband this act of intimacy. And that's fine. That's as it should be.
Right. And if that's not happening, and the only place it's being communicated is... with intercourse, then it's a very barren relationship. It's not, it's the commitment to become one is not happening.
Yeah.
The other thing you were talking about, erotically passing the salt. I can actually say that. That's what I was thinking. I wondered if you could define erotic, because I think that you would also mean that you could be doing something that is not about I'm inviting you into a sexual act, but I'm inviting you to depend on me. I'm telling you that you're special. And I wouldn't use the word that's necessarily erotic, but I guess it's eros. I mean, I guess we use the term erotic more commonly in this culture as really narrowly connected to a sexual act
right.
of some kind.
Right.
And you're meaning eros in general, that love, that commitment. Is that why you said
Well, actually, no, I was using it the way we do in our culture, that, okay. that we have turned it into a sexual act, even though it's not inherently and intrinsically a sexual act. I think that we can turn things into a sexual act.
Okay. So. But we can also be dishonest by communicating specialness
yeah.
when we're not going to follow through on that, inviting someone to rest in our primary regard of them, that they're the most important when we're not going to be there when later. And that's something I think that unlike, it's easy to mess up on line with our bodies in the midst of the tumble of our emotions and our chemistry. That's easy. It's even easier to mess up on the communication of your special with nothing physical involved and communicating too much of that, raising someone's expectations. And I think that we have to know that we're going to mess up on that. But it's the commitment to try to be honest about that. But we're definitely going to mess up. It's too... I was talking to someone a couple weeks ago. Once you're attracted to someone, I think that unconsciously, almost everything you're going to do is going to want to pull towards communicating that. It's going to be the conscious effort of going the other direction to not communicate that before you feel like you can do so with integrity. I think it's really, really hard.
Yeah, good point. And we'll talk more about that in future weeks. But no, but that's a good point.
Could you comment on romance? And is that what you mean by erotic? I mean, or could you differentiate?
No, not in the way I'm using it now. Oh. And we'll have a whole, I think next week, that's the topic.
Is romance?
So, yeah.
Okay.
I'll just add that I think in regards to Stefan's question about lines and boundaries and that sort of thing, I don't think that sexual intimacy was made in such a way that it should be begun and then stopped. It really should be begun and completed. And so in that sense, beginning a sexual act, that I think that's kind of maybe the sense in which you're saying the word erotic, because it can lead to a promise of offering my body then, because that's what we're communicating with a touch of a hand or a passing of the salt, maybe. But I think we kind of have this model that says, you know, first base, second base, all that. As long as you stop below, above the waist, then it's okay. But the fact is, we're not really supposed to stop. It's like it's meant to keep going. And so it's a really artificial stopping that we're doing there. And it's kind of almost a whiplash in a way. And I think that's something to keep in mind. Like, is what I'm about to be doing going to need to be stopped? Is maybe a good question to ask when deciding what can I do that's okay. And, you know, the bad news is not much that, you know, couldn't keep going and want to get going. But that's one way to think about it.
As far as passing the salt erotically or, you know, it sounds silly, but what if your gesture is just misinterpreted? You have no intention on passing the salt erotically, but the person who's receiving it interprets it that way. I mean, it seems that like
that's the
saying
complexity.
Erotic gestures can be. I mean, there's a really fine line there. It seems to me.
Like, right, and that gestures can be misinterpreted, and that's what's so difficult and what's so clumsy about the male-female relationship is that those miscommunications happen quite frequently. And that, okay, so we live in a world that we're going to have to bumble our way through, but all we can do is guard our own hearts and our own minds to try to be pure in our own intentions and our own hearts. We're not responsible for how other people read them. So.
And yet I think we can take a certain sense of information back if we're misunderstood a lot, that maybe I'm communicating something without being aware of it, and I need to look at that. Especially if I get feedback from, you know, if it happens kind of in a pattern, it could be a good question to ask.
That's why people always whistle at me when I pass the salt.
You're right.
Keeps happening.
Yep.
Yeah.
But so in a sense, you're saying we should have, until there's that moment of integrity, have the reaction like Joseph did?
Until there's that... what do you mean by until there's that moment of integrity?
Well, if it's not possible, for instance, to have what you were talking about previously, just about passing the salt even, if that even happens, or... I'll never forget that one, Gabe. Sorry. But, I mean, are you saying we should have a reaction to those small things with the same reaction Joseph had with his master's wife?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, just to the desire for sexual intimacy is the strongest, maybe not the strongest, but is one of the strongest desires that we ever face. And so it's always going to be interesting. I mean, I can only speak from a male perspective, but from a male perspective, it's always interesting. It's an inherently interesting idea to my makeup, to my created makeup. The issue is that human beings are supposed to be moral in everything they do. You know, it's not self-justifying to do something because I want to. I always have to ask the further question, but would it be right? Would it be good? Would it be in keeping with love and justice and truth and godliness to do this? So, you know, the fact that some woman is trying to seduce me, as Joseph did, the right response would be, no, this would be wrong. So I will run if I need to. I will flee if I need to take myself out of this situation.
So even if you can't fight it off, or you know you can't at all, just leave it, basically?
Sure.
But then you'd have to die, in some sense. What I say.
Well, maybe I'm not understanding your question, then.
Well, in some senses, isn't there... I don't know how to articulate what I'm trying to say, fully.
Can I take a stab?
Yes.
It certainly seems appropriate to avoid... a circumstance like the one that Joseph was in, and to flee in that sense. What you're saying is you kind of still have to live in the world, and Jack is saying sex is always inherently interesting. I think it's actually, it's in a little bit different wiring for women, but it's inherently interesting to women also. So how do we stay in the same room together? That's what you're saying. Is that it? Like, how... I'd have to die. I have to not be around anybody if I'm going to really be pure. And I think it's helpful to understand that the decisions that I make to say yes or no to something in the way that Jack is talking about, deciding I'm going to be asking, is this a good thing to do or not a good thing to do? I'm also going to be working with the fact that it's a messy place that we live, and that even if I keep my body entirely pure, I'm going to blow it. You know, I'm going to want things that I shouldn't want. I'm going to be drawn to things I shouldn't be drawn to. And that's part of what it's like to be a sinner. And I think mostly what we can confront that with is self-awareness and an understanding of who we are, and just a real honesty before God with that. Because that's why we need mercy, because we can't get it right. We're not going to be pure in this kind of ultimate, absolute sense. But we're going to be wanting it and striving after it and knowing when we've blown it and kind of going, having that raise the question over and over, what do I really want? I mean, does that...
I'm sorry. And don't mistake moral purity and sexual purity for sexlessness.
Well, no, I'm not saying that.
Okay.
At all.
Because I think there are currents within Christian culture sometimes that sort of encourage you to think in terms of any sort of interest in the opposite sex is what they call lust. And we all know that lust is wrong, and so we beat ourselves up for being male, or we beat ourselves up for being female. And I don't think that's right. I mean, the question often gets asked, did Jesus ever find females interesting? For example, here's a sinless human being, but a male. Was his body ever responsive to the femaleness of a female? My own answer to that would be, well, sure. But it was just always unthinkable to him to ever act on it, because he wanted to be righteous. It didn't really matter how his body was responding. He wasn't going to act on it. That's the purity. That's the moral purity of a sexual being. Not becoming completely, numb, oblivious, anesthetized to the biological realities of being a sexual being.
So how does the dynamic of the mind then, how does God's mercy overcome that? Because that would be a process of sanctification, I would think.
Overcome which now? What were you talking about?
Well, the passing the salt thing. Or whatever.
Doing something erotically that...
Well, not even erotically, but flirtation, I guess, is the way to put it. Because it says here that you made a statement that flirtation is even a doorway or whatever in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the dynamic of the mind with the thoughts and mercy overcome that, so you can stand before a person in integrity without that struggle? If that's
well,
clear.
Well, if you, I don't know if we, that, I think that's Nancy's point. Because we're sinners, it's not going to be without a struggle. We are going to struggle with this. But if you're asking me how do I overcome my proclivity towards sexual immorality and sexual impurity, by falling in love with righteousness. I mean, I don't think it's by, I think it's by allowing my heart and mind to be captivated by an entirely different vision for what it means to be a human being, so that my heart and mind is so given over to what I want is to be a man or woman of such integrity and such purity that the commitments of my heart are always to do what's honorable and pure and good and righteous and holy and so on. The more you get convinced that that's what your life is going to be about, the more you become empowered to say no to immorality, I think.
So basically love Jesus.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Is what you're saying.
Yeah.
In a very...
In everything that he stands for.
All right. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Continuing along that line of thought, you were talking about men will always find women interesting, I think you said, and women will always find men interesting. Okay, so then you get married, and you have like three options. Either you only find your spouse interesting, or nothing's interesting, or kind of like when you're not married, the opposite sex is still interesting, but you would never act on it because
it's the third.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that getting married doesn't solve the problem of finding other emails. other females interesting. They are going to be interesting to me biologically, and so it's a question of what am I committed to. Is it important to me that I've made a promise to my wife and I'm going to keep that promise, and therefore there is nothing here worth exploring or thinking about or wondering about, because this is unthinkable that there's anything here to act on.
So in movies, when the girlfriend gets really mad because the boyfriend says that other girl was pretty, that's because in our society, the guy, you know, people think on that curiosity and then acting on it's the logical next step. Right? So that's why people have a huge reaction to, well, you're with me, why do you think other people are pretty, or whatever.
They're more likely to have a big reaction to that if they aren't as secure in the marriage.
Yeah.
Also. The more secure one is in the marriage, the less threatening that could be.
Yeah, I think that's huge. The security is the issue. Because if you have two people who know that their commitment is real, then they can be a lot more free in admitting things like that to each other without it being in any way a threat.
Thanks.
Isn't that one of the problems of having multiple relationships before you get married? Is you've both broken up a number of times, and the insecurity level increases significantly to where it's hard to trust another person.
Could be. I haven't thought about that, but yeah, it could be.
Then here's a more personal question in that same area. What happens if someone is in a relationship and they know that they are committed to the point of marriage and their heart is truly committed, but they, let's say, confess that struggle, that at times they will find others attractive outside of the relationship, but they are not committed to breaking the commitment of going to marriage, but it's a struggle, I guess, of little interest here and there outside of the person who you're already committed to. And you make that confession, and a person replies along the lines of, how can you really love me if this and this happens? Or, how can you be truly committed? Is that a misunderstanding on their part of what commitment is, or a misunderstanding of what a human is?
It could be a misunderstanding of what's loving to communicate. If someone is truly committed and you're moving toward marriage, it might not be the time to, if there's a real genuine struggle going on, then you're wanting to be working with that. But your betrothed might be not be the person to work with that with. Does that make sense? So in other words, I want to think about what does it look like to love this person that I'm promising myself to? Does it look like letting her know on the way to the altar that I really struggle with being attracted to other women? That might not help the marriage bond begin well. And so that's something to think about. Now, if you're on your way to the altar and you really are struggling with that, I think that should raise legitimate questions about whether or not this is a commitment that you're really wanting to make. And then that is a conversation you might want to have with a trusted friend or a mentor, pastor, parent. But to be working that through and really be looking at that honestly, it may be more loving to do that away from the actual relationship. Does that make sense?
Would that be an example of where God says some are made to possibly be single at all? Or would that be, if that's clear?
Well, if I'm understanding what you're saying, what I'm suggesting is it's built into my maleness as a human male that I'm going to have some kind of physical response to females. That in and of itself is no violation and is not wrong. It's what I do with that it makes it a violation. The reason that would be threatening, to a woman in our society is because of the mythology that we've all imbibed. We believe that this mythology that we believe is that you fall in love with somebody, you're attracted to someone, you're drawn to someone, and that becomes the right person to be with. And how many movies do we have where you have a marriage relationship and then the true love comes along? And we have the whole audience cheering for the person who's going to dump their spouse and go to their true love. Because we all know we need to be with our true love. Even Walt Disney knows that. You know, so because we have so completely bought into that mythology, then what's going to be heard if you were asked, do you ever find other women attractive, interesting, or whatever, by saying yes, they see that as a threat. Right, so part of what we all have to understand is to come to a sober, truthful, and realistic understanding of the nature and dynamics of human sexuality. Know what is a threat, what isn't a threat, what's real, what's not real. I just think we have to learn what it is and how it works.
But then, if what Nancy was saying, wouldn't that disagree with what you say in the handout here that the person who you're supposed to be most intimate with your emotions and the struggles, should be your spouse? Isn't that a false way of entering into the covenant of marriage and not a honest way?
Yeah, but, and one learns this very quickly in marriage. If I'm feeling something that I myself know in my wisdom has no substance to it and is not important, I'm not doing my spouse any favor by sharing that with her. Because it's not true, right? I mean, for example, if for some reason Cupid were to shoot his arrow and all of a sudden I was just completely intrigued by another woman, but I know there's no substance to that because I know being shot by Cupid's arrow doesn't mean nothing. So I know there's no substance to it. What am I gaining? Why am I doing anything important by sharing that with my spouse, who can only be threatened by it, who can only be made fearful about it, and I know there's nothing to it. I'm just going to deal with it.
That's the misunderstanding that I was trying to relay before with the dynamic of the mind and what is, like, if all, okay. Every thought that comes into your mind, are you responsible for every thought?
I see.
In the same way.
Yeah.
As you are actions with the intention.
No, it's what we do with them.
Story. Let's fantasize. I'm not just having my physical reaction and my immediate mental emotional picture. I'm instead of trying to act with integrity with that, I might not do anything with my body, but I could do a lot of wrong and harm with fantasy.
Yeah. And that's the mistake that gets made, is that people see lust as a purely mental thing, which it is. That's a good point. You know, inappropriate fantasizing, sexual desire, sexual interest can be only mental and not physical. But you have to make a distinction between that and simply visceral, immediate responsiveness. That those are different. You see what I'm saying? Okay.
So I met this guy once who told me that he was giving me advice. He liked to give advice. And he told me that I should, before I get married, sleep with the woman that I'm considering getting married so that I know that, that we're a good match. And at first I was sort of like, well, that's ridiculous. But then I had an experience, a few experiences, with kissing. And it's kind of personal, but I guess I'll share it. Now that it's out there. The first girlfriend that I had, I thought was like the most amazing kiss I had ever experienced. And so I thought it was always going to be like that. And then I found out it wasn't. And I was sort of like, what's the deal? Like, am I doing something wrong? Are they doing something wrong? And so, so from that experience, I kind of understood maybe a little bit of what he was saying. I don't know what you have to say to that.
If you'd had the second kiss first, I wonder what you would have thought.
Yeah.
Just a thought.
That's not really an answer.
The main thing to... I mean, this becomes very important in marriage because it really doesn't make any difference who you marry. For us as males, the idea of novelty is probably will always be pretty interesting to us. So when you've experienced sexual intimacy with one woman, the question is, well, what about somebody else? What would that be all about? And if if sex is about having interesting sex, if that's what it's for, then promiscuity makes a lot of sense. And having new, fresh adventures and conquests and so on and so forth. But that's not what it's all about. It doesn't matter how good the sex is, as the world would call good. Every act of sexual intimacy is meaningful, even if it's not good. And that's the wonderful thing about sex, is the real reward of it, which is the relationship, and the meaning of the relationship is never bad. Unless the relationship is bad, right? But I mean, the sex is always capable of communicating what sex is intended to communicate. And the fact of the matter is, your sexual experience throughout the course of your lifetime is going to be very different and varied. And sometimes it's going to be very mundane and ordinary. Sometimes it's going to be very exciting and very interesting. And it depends on all kinds of things. How many kids do you have? How tired are you? How stressed are you? There's just so many things that go into what your actual sexual experience is going to be like. And the people who have the worst time are the people who are striving to have good sex. Because that's a lot of pressure. And usually if you strive too hard to have good sex, you have terrible sex, because it just can't work that way. The most important thing somebody can do is just relax and not care whether your sex is good sex. Because it'll always be meaningful. It will always be a bond of intimacy and unity and commitment and a celebration of the commitment. And you can't take that away from it. As long as your relationship is sound and solid and good, then it means that. And it means what your relationship is to you. So that's, again, a part of the mythology of our culture, is that what makes the world go around is good sex. That's just nonsense. It's not worth it. Even good sex would get boring, because it's not very substantive in and of itself. It's the relationship that has the substance to it, not the sex. And by the way, the statistics are that people who have lived together before they get married have a higher divorce rate than people who don't.
And I would just also add that people who are married for a long time can have better and better sex, because they get better at it, and they learn more and more about one another, and they grow into really relating well. So, you know, an initial chemistry is sometimes can just be about clumsiness and not necessarily something more meaningful than that.
Yeah, exactly. Notice the language the Bible uses. To have sexual intercourse is to know Adam knew his wife. Well, you don't know her immediately. It's a lifetime of studying her and getting to know her, and that's true in the act of sex as well as anything else.
I've heard you talk about this before, and there's a piece that I think it would be important for people to hear, and you alluded to it, Nancy, is that it's, you're not going to make the priority having good sex, but there's a joy in seeking to give pleasure to the one you love and to receive pleasure from the one that you love. And if there's a incompatibility, clumsiness, woundedness, that makes it very difficult, very unpleasurable, there can still be in the effort to love one another through that, whether that be going without something ourselves, seeking to serve the other one, all that communicating that you were talking about happening.
Yeah.
But you're not anti-pleasure.
No, no.
But you're anti-making that the priority.
Yeah.
I wasn't the one that gave Julian that advice. just to let everyone know that.
Or the kiss.
I was the first one. JK. I guess what I was going to ask was,
part of me was hoping to, by the towards the end of this conversation, have a feeling, have less of a feeling of taboo around sexuality. And it hasn't really worked out. It's almost like within the Christian culture, there, you know, sexuality and being sexually active is this thing that people who are in a relationship are just looking forward to. And so there's this, I get this, the feeling that there's this desire to rush into marriage and rush into relationships in order to arrive at sexual intercourse. And I'm wondering if there's any way to approach sexuality and take away this, just this, we need to get married because we want to have sex with each other, because we love each other. And I mean, part of me wants to think that that's the reason why the divorce rate has gone up within the Christian community, is also because young people get married early on within the Christian community in order to have sex, because then it's okay. And so I don't see how to get around that, and I'm wondering if you had any insight on that.
I'm not sure I understand the connection between it being taboo and sex outside of marriage being taboo. Oh, okay. Okay, I see. It seems like taboo has a connotation that sin does not, and that's the place to start. See, if you grow up in an environment that tells you don't you dare sin, and you find yourself sinning, let's say sexually, that you're being sexually immoral, and you confront the guilt of that, and you don't know what to do with the guilt of that. And one way to handle that guilt is to try to turn it into something that's righteous by getting married. I've slept with you. I guess I better marry you. Maybe that's part of the phenomenon that you're talking about. What would be better is for me to come to terms with the fact that I am a sinner and receive the grace and the mercy and the forgiveness that comes from God, rather than making a foolish decision in order to try to cover up who I am and what I am. So part of it's just lousy theology that really doesn't come to terms with the reality of human sinfulness, doesn't understand the role of God's grace and God's mercy in our lives. That's a lot of it, because there's so much of Christianity that completely doesn't understand that part of our faith, and all it really understands is come to Jesus and be really, really good. I mean, that's Christianity for them. Whereas the Bible says, come to Jesus because you ain't very good at all. That's why you need to come to Jesus. So good theology would help a ton. There is, you know, clearly from a biblical worldview, because sex is made by God, it's not dirty. There's nothing dirty about it. There's nothing inappropriate about it. There's nothing corrupt about it. It's good and wonderful. So we're not Platonists who believe that because it's physical, it's yucky. I mean that and now we may have been enculturated to that, but that's not because our faith tells us that. That's because we've been enculturated into that kind of perspective. On the other hand, I think I understand where that comes from, and that is we do feel dirty when we are sexually immoral, and I think the reason we feel that way, it took me a long time to figure this out, but I think the reason we do that is because we when we treat my sexuality as if it's bestial sexuality, I feel subhuman because I have bestialized myself. And we mistake that sense of having dehumanized myself with a sense of feeling dirty. And I would argue that's an appropriate emotional response to that, because we did dehumanize ourselves by not exercising the kind of self-control that a rational moral being exercises over their impulses. Animals just act on their impulses. If I just act on my impulses, I'm acting like an animal. And I sense that, and I know that, and I feel that, and I go, oh, yuck, who am I? Am I just an animal? And so I think that that feeling of degradation is sort of appropriate in a way, because I really kind of have done that. But it's not because sex is degrading. That's the mistake we make. It's because a lack of self-control is degrading. And we mistake the one for the other. I'm not sure I addressed all of your
issues. I come from a pretty conservative Christian Southern Baptist background, where growing up, you know, sex outside of marriage was just wrong. I mean, they actually made it sound that the act of sex was a dirty, rotten thing. And when I moved to Italy and was with non-Christians and people who had no religious background whatsoever, their arguments towards the beauty of sexuality and their arguments towards having sex just without commitment being okay sounded like it worked. And because of the way sex was taught so badly to me in this other context. And so it's hard to break that mold. And I guess that's just why I wanted to address that, because it's so hard to get away from it.
Yeah, it is. And right, from both sides.
Right.
Yes, yeah. And I think part of why it makes sense to me that you would be drawn to the freer view is because they're really right about the beauty of it. And that's what's been so beaten up in the really conservative Christian circles. It's very unfortunate. Because then, I mean, one of my issues with that is, you know, you have young people who get married out of that culture, and after hating themselves for any kind of sexual desire they have ever felt in their lives, suddenly they're supposed to flip a switch, and here I am, be sexual with me. It's not going to happen. It's really difficult to make that shift to where I can actually appreciate that I have a sexual body and then decide to share it in a relationship. It's a beautiful thing to be able to do. But that crunched down view doesn't help us do that. And so I guess I'm just saying I can really sympathize with entering into a culture where it's free and wonderful and beautiful and embraced. And it's like, yeah, because I think they're right about it. Now, what they're not right about is that the freedom part, that it's beautiful and wonderful and engaging in that way when it's in the context of communicating what it's meant to communicate. And when it's done freely and promiscuously, then it gets broken in a different way. And I think that's really true also. It really does get broken, but not in the way that we were told originally. I don't know if that's helpful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because they're putting blinders on and not looking at all the pain in their wake. Yeah, it's beautiful at the moment, but you're leaving all kinds of wounded people behind that you've lied to, you've ripped off, you've deceived, you've destroyed, you've created all kinds of grief and pain in their life, but you're happy. What a beautiful thing sexuality is.
But I think it's a really big issue, the taboo that you're talking about, rather than facing into the reality of what does it look like to have self-control. And so if I'm thinking instead of having self-control, then I can know that I have sexual responses, my body responds a certain way, and it's supposed to. It's okay for it to do that. It's made to do that, and it's a gift that it does that. and yet I get to decide, using my self-control, how am I going to work with that in my life? How am I going to express that toward another person or not? And how can I be responsible with that? And that's where I think it's a very ennobling and a very humanizing experience to work with it on that level of self-control rather than on the level of pretend it's not there and deny, or however you might think about doing that. But I think that's a really big issue in Christian culture. It's very unfortunate.
Did that? Time for one more.
One of the things that I've been thinking about lately, and I'm not sure how accurate it is, it might be something a little unhealthy about this perspective, but it seems like there's a complete, undue and disproportionate emphasis placed on sex, and not just like the right or the wrong context for it, or and this is, I mean, fully recognizing that our sexuality is a large part of our psyches and our bodies, and to some extent like a significant part of our like biological function. there's still like an entire like an entire life and world like full of other things as well, and other experiences and other very enthralling like sort of endeavors and discoveries, and there's this kind of like myth around sex as though it's the sum of like everything happy, everything like that's worth living for is found in sex, just as long as you have it in the right context. And that seems like a complete misunderstanding of like life and like the breadth and scope of life. And that's not to like de-emphasize like the beauty and the meaning of sex, but it's so easy to have to like lose perspective and consider sex to be like the pinnacle of happiness on earth, when in fact it's just like it's just the thing. It's just like every like some life full of things. Like sex is just another thing. I don't know. Maybe that's a little too like simplistic or not like maybe too idealistic. I don't know.
I think you're dead on right. I think that's true. That's why the purest art form or the purest music form is folk music, because they actually find other things to sing about. No, they don't. Well, the old folk music. I mean, pop music is incredible. You'd think there's nothing else in the world.
I was thinking that about you. We have the advertisers to thank for that also.
Yeah.
We are inundated with messages that say this is the be-all and end-all of human existence.
And it seems like very biologically obvious too, like you, with emotions and like everything, mm-hmm. and hormones, and there's this like this promise of this like euphoric sublime experience, and it's very easy and very very obvious, and in a way that most of life isn't easy and obvious, even if there weren't like the like media inundation of like sexuality, I think that it would still be very easy to have a perspective that sort of amplifies sex into this fulfilling thing that it's really not. I mean, not just sex, but even like that like man woman relationship, as though like this is going to be this like missing piece in my life. Like, yeah.
Now, I think it is true that it's a deep yearning. I think that's true, and so that's what gives plausibility to the myth of our culture. But I think you're absolutely right that what we have done is we've bought into, again, a mythology about relationships and sex and even marriage in that regard, that this is the thing that's going to give you fulfillment itself. This is life itself to you. So find this. And it just doesn't work that way. So I think you're right. We do need to wrap it up here. Let me just close with one last comment. The other thing, along with Stefan's comment about the taboo of sex, one of the things that I think got ingrained in me in the Christian culture I grew up with is that sexual immorality is the unforgivable sin. And that simply is not true. And in our day and age, with all the pressures and temptations and confusions and mythologies out there, lots of people are going to be making lots of mistakes with their sexuality. And I think it's just important to realize that it's not unforgivable. A sin is sin. And if not that, there's other forms of sin that we commit as well. It's just part of coming to know what it means to be a broken human being, to be fundamentally selfish in a way that makes me not what God wanted me to be. Learn to come to terms with that. Accept God's grace and forgiveness for that. Pick myself up and grow in wisdom. You know, it's not anything to beat yourself up about any more than any other sin that you commit. So you got to keep it in perspective, because it's easy to think that the heinousness of sexual immorality is somehow especially egregious, but it's not.
Yeah, which is interesting, because as you were saying before, sexual impurity does have a psychical effect on us that is very degrading in a way. And so it's a good distinction to make that could be a psychological reality and not a spiritual reality.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, thank you. I think we talk about love and romance next week.